We've got a massive new prediction on the Joe Biden for president front from the immediate past co-host, Elizabeth Warren. Groundbreaking report from yours truly. And yes, we go into the details, the dirty details of Justice Kavanaugh's briefs on this episode of The Uprising.
LibertyNation.com. They're the resistance, but we are the uprising. With Scott Cosenza.
I felt this thrill going up my leg.
There's not going to be a President Donald Trump.
A president! Can you believe it?
This is somebody who knows what's right and what's wrong.
You know what podcasts are, by the way?
Talk shows for people who cannot make it in talk radio.
I just want to say to the men in this country, just shut up, do the right thing. For a change.
I think possibly that's the most unattractive form in which prejudice can be met in this country, is the rage of the entitled.
In studio for the full episode, Tim Donner, Archie the podcasting dog. We've got judicial, insert favorite euphemism for male private part, and we're going to be talking, not because it's our preference, but because the situation demands a lot about Justice Kavanaugh's private parts. So for tender ears, you may want to have them leave the room. And we've got...
now we have to do a countdown.
A Biden update. And I'm going to have a Warren update with her big rally on the show. So thank you for joining us, Tim.
I think we should do a countdown to prurient interest.
Tim, I think that
prurient interest coming in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
The warning's been issued. I formally requested of LibertyNation.com editor-in-chief permission to call this podcast Kavanaugh's Penis and was denied permission to do so. So I wasn't denied the ability to speak those words.
That's a risky decision by the editor-in-chief.
I thought it was it wasn't clickbait. It was a good title. It accurately reflected what we're going to have to talk about. Tim, I think you know I would much rather criticize Judge Kavanaugh's jurisprudence, which I find to be intolerably
establishment
reflexively accommodating to establishment powers. Yes, sir. And insufficiently protective of individual liberty.
Deferential to the state.
Yes.
As is a common problem on the Supreme Court.
I have to go into exhaustive detail about, and I was thinking if this is, and maybe you can help me, Tim. I don't know if it's fake news or some other category of something that's even worse than fake news. And here's what I mean by that. It's not just that something, they say something happened that didn't happen. And that new thing, by the way, is some kind of a sexual impropriety allegation made against Judge Kavanaugh. That didn't happen. But what they do is they actually cover up something that did happen that damns the previous allegation. So to lead into it, I want to play Amy Goodman from Democracy Now. Here's how we start to learn the story, the most recent story about Judge Kavanaugh.
Calls are mounting to impeach Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh after new evidence and new allegations of sexual misconduct were reported by the New York Times over the weekend. Deborah Ramirez, a former Yale classmate of Kavanaugh's, accused him of pulling down his pants and thrusting his penis at her during a drunken party, forcing her to touch it while she swatted it away from her. Kavanaugh denied the accusation during his confirmation hearings, but the New York Times found at least seven people, including Ramirez's mother, knew of the incident for years. Some had learned of it in the days after it happened. The New York Times also uncovered another similar incident in which Kavanaugh's friends pushed his penis into the hand of a female student at another party. The FBI never followed up on a list of 25 people provided by Ramirez who could corroborate her story, nor did they follow up on information about the second incident.
Okay. By the way, I mean, you just can't get past the first of all, the hilarious mechanics of it. Like, is this a set of car keys? It's a man's penis, right? How does one person push another man's penis into a third person's hand?
You're taking this a lot deeper than it needs
to go. I'm getting like Zapruder analysis on this, Tim.
Yeah, you are, and you don't need to because it's so patently obvious just based on the track record of the establishment media for the last 4 years. Here's a question.
Go ahead.
Framed as a statement. Why is it, if this was just an inaccuracy, as they claim, or actually an editor error, as they claim, was written into the original story, they claim, but the editors took out just one fact, the fact that the victim did not remember the incident.
And please do not use that word victim. That is a word for
the alleged victim.
That's a word for Robin Pogrebin and Kate Kelly to assign to somebody.
What more do you need to know than the fact that the New York Times, which has been on a vendetta to take down Donald Trump and kneecap him from the moment he came down? You know what? Even if what they say, here's the point, Scott. Even if what they say is actually true, nobody's going to believe it.
Okay, so this is why. Yes.
Here's the two words, Scott. Crying wolf.
Right. All right. Well, I think that for you and for people that are kind of on that wavelength, that's bought and sold and done with. But there are other people, Tim, who haven't kind of been paying attention as much to this nefariousness in reporting. And I think we need to spell it out for them. So all the headlines that talk about new allegations, right? I could play you a million clips. New allegations, new allegations. That's an allegation is that person did something to me or someone else. This is not an allegation of any wrongdoing. Literally, you heard the allegation by Amy Goodman. It is a classmate saw Mr. Kavanaugh with his pants down at a drunken dorm party where friends pushed his penis into the hands of a female student. This is somehow – now, here – now, after that was released, by the way, this is the New York Times story, there were multiple calls for Kavanaugh's impeachment by the presidential contenders.
Of course there were.
Now, here's what I want to know. Is that a high crime or is that a misdemeanor when a third party pushes your penis into the hand of some drunken dorm room partygoer who, by the way—
As a freshman in college— I don't even want to give it the credibility of saying, "Well, look, he was a freshman in college." The woman doesn't remember it. What more do we need to know? And they're reporting it, and they leave out that one fact. What more do people need to know that it is?
There's a bigger story.
A witch
we may
hunt.
Not even know about the bigger story. We're burying the lead. We're doing exactly what I criticized them for doing. So I apologize for that. The bigger story, Tim, is Leland Kaiser. Do you know the name Leland Kaiser? Does that ring a bell?
Yes.
So Leland Kaiser is the lifelong friend of Christine Blasey Ford. Tim, you can say it. It's doctor, okay?
Dr. Christine.
Right.
The
woman who alleges that Brett Kavanaugh either attempted to rape her or mock attempted to rape her in some fashion at a party in Bethesda, Maryland when they were both teenagers. And she was at the party with... Ford says that Kaiser was at the party with Ford. Not that she told her at the time of the attack, but that they were at the party together. Kaiser now, according to this book, okay, this new article, which is featuring information from this book, she says now that she doesn't have credibility, that Ford's story basically doesn't hold water. She finds it not credible. In other words,
that's her
Ms.
Yeah, that's her BFF you're talking about.
The one that everybody was saying. Oh, and here's what else we're learning. Again, you want to talk about a buried lead. The group of friends who knew Ms. Ford and Ms. Kaiser,
right?
Democrats almost all, and movement Democrats now, Tim, were talking about what they could do to motivate Ms. Kaiser to more forcefully support, who, by the way, has no indication that she's involved politically in any way, but they're going to try to release information, Tim, about her substance abuse history to try to motivate her. Basically, hey, you better get on board with this nomination.
It's blackmail. That's what it is. Let's just call it what it is. And, Scott, here's the bottom line of this part. There's not a single piece of corroborating evidence from Christine Blasey Ford, unless you can name one that I haven't seen and I've looked pretty closely.
Well, we have to go through some of the evidence, and I think it's really important because, again, it's not just instead of the new information revealing damaging information for Justice Kavanaugh, which is what the New York Times and the sort of headline people would have us believe, it's actually the exact opposite. What you know, the wake of these this publication should be that we have more confidence in Justice Kavanaugh's account. The name, so there's a few names here that people need to be familiar with. One of them is Deborah Ramirez, and another one is James Roche. Yeah. Deborah Ramirez is we heard about in the lead-in. She alleged that she was at another drunken dorm party in Yale when somebody was passing around a dildo, Tim, and the kids were all laughing about it. And then at some point, Kavanaugh was naked and near her, and she swatted him away, and her hand touched his penis. Okay, again. Kavanaugh's penis. Well, I know, right? This is law just, school does not prepare you for.
Excuse me, I got to get up and go to the dentist. Right. So enjoy better, yourself. Right. Yeah.
But they act like, first of all, again, if it did happen, what's the problem there in terms of? This means he's going to what? Physically assault a litigant before the Supreme Court? It's ridiculous. Again, this is his freshman year in college. But in any case, it's a lie how they're reporting that. And I just want to keep all the details of this, Tim. It seems like are
everything.
Rife with lies. So we heard, for instance, in the lead-in story from Amy Goodman that Ramirez's mother knew about this for decades or years. Well, that's all BS. What happened was Ms. Ramirez said there was some incident at Yale that her intimates were familiar with, but not the name Kavanaugh. And only after he was nominated, Tim, did she discover through self-analysis and checking with friends and whatever that it must have been him who did it. And as a matter of fact, Kavanaugh is asked, and this is from the New York Times piece, during his Senate testimony, Mr. Kavanaugh says that if the incident Ms. Ramirez described had occurred, it would have been, quote, the talk of campus. Okay, then they go on to say, our reporting suggests that it was. Now, here's where we get the important part. Do you know who was Ms. Ramirez's dear friend during her Yale years who saw them as her protector, this innocent rube at the big Yale school?
No idea.
It was James Roche, Justice Kavanaugh's first year freshman roommate, who does not like Judge Kavanaugh, didn't want him on the Supreme Court.
For ideological reasons?
Oh, yeah, and personal, by the way, deeply personal reasons, okay? And he was up and down talking, by the way, and I believe James Roche to be an honest man, and you know why I believe him to be an honest man? Because I believe he deeply does not want Kavanaugh to be on the Supreme Court. And he could have said that he recalled these allegations. That might have been a real problem for him. But he didn't. And you may say, well, what's the big deal?
Simple honesty.
What's the big deal? He was Kavanaugh's roommate. Well, if he's dear friends with Ms. Ramirez and he's in opposition to Kavanaugh, which we know are true, he doesn't remember this incident, which was the talk of campus? Mm-hmm. Well, it doesn't pass the smell test.
But yeah, this points out something that is endemic to the extremes of the Me Too movement, which is that if you make an allegation against someone, the strategy is always to make an allegation that can't be categorically disproved. Mm-hmm. You can't prove a negative. You can't prove it never happened. So all you have to do, as in the case of Christine Blasey Ford, is you bring forward someone who's willing to take a beating for the sake of making an allegation for which there is no corroborating evidence. She didn't know where she was. She couldn't point to the place. Nobody remembers anything like it. I mean, on and on and on.
I think that she may believe it, Christine Blasey Ford.
Maybe.
I'm not willing to call her a liar,
yeah,
but I am willing to say that her account is not convincing enough to, you know,
it's not even close, Scott. She has no corroborating evidence.
One thing we know is that rapists or sexual assaulters, the likelihood that it's a one-and-done situation is almost nil for a man of his years. But that's why there's so much value, Tim, in subsequent and other evidence instances of sexual misconduct. That's why there's power in these allegations, and that's why I think a person like Ramirez is incentivized to come forward with them. And we now know, again, that Blasey Ford's best friend, Leland Kaiser, was, I'll use your word, blackmailed. I mean, you know, applying a lever of pressure to say, you better do X, and X is denigrate this nominee.
Or else we will release X information.
We'll try to ruin you.
That's blackmail, yeah. Plain and simple. Let's call it what it is.
And why isn't that the lead in the New York Times?
Well, the New York Times, look, here's what they're saying. They're saying, oh, it was a simple editorial error. Come on.
Well, let me stop you right there and explain what you're talking about, because I don't think we laid the foundation. So when they published this piece, okay?
Objection, Your Honor. No foundation.
And when they published this piece called Brett Kavanaugh Fit In With the Privileged Kid, She Did Not. I love that. That was a subtitle, right. I think. What they didn't include was the detail that the woman, okay, so this is the for the fresh allegation that they're able to print by this person called Max Steyer, who saw Mr. Kavanaugh with his pants down at a different drunken party where his friends pushed his penis into the hands of a female student. Now, Mr. Steyer, Tim, we learn, was willing to tell this story to anybody who would listen, except for anybody who would want him to be under oath when he testified about it. So it's a bit curious because he doesn't actually allege any criminal behavior or any really any kind of even sexual assaultee behavior, right? Unless you think being naked in a dorm room is somehow criminal and drunk.
I think you're drilling
so much deeper than you need to know exactly what they're doing. They didn't include, this is Ms. Pogrebin and Ms. Kelly did not include in their story. So, all right, I feel like I want to make cut that out, but I won't. I'll leave this all in. These two women published a book. They're also New York Times writers. They wrote the story, basically excerpting their own book and getting some free publicity for it in the New York Times. What they wrote in their book was the woman from these Max Steyer allegations didn't basically deny that she had any knowledge of it. Her friend said she didn't know what they were talking about and she didn't want to be on the record and be interviewed. They left that part out of the New York Times
story. She said her official position is she did not remember
it. Right, she did not remember it. And Molly Hemingway, the Federalist writer.
Superb.
It's true.
Yeah.
She's really good on Twitter, too. She took to her Twitter account. She received an advanced copy of this book. And she took to Twitter to say, hey, basically, small detailed omission here from this article. The woman says that she has no recollection of the event happening. And then the New York Times comes in and says, oh, we regret the error, or maybe not even
editorial error.
Yeah.
We have one of the reporters, Ms. Kelly, mm-hmm. talking about this when she was on with Lawrence O'Donnell on MSNBC, asking leading questions, giving her a soft landing on the answer. I know you're shocked that... That kind of thing would happen.
Had I known that it was a Lawrence O'Donnell clip, I may have already said it. I forbid it. But
you're going to hear his voice for a moment.
There was zero intent to mislead anybody about the details of the incident. That excerpt that we ran in the Times was an adaptation of what's in our book. We included the additional detail about this other as yet unreported allegation.
In your draft of the article, did it include those words that have since been added to the article?
It did. I think what happened actually was that, you know, we had her name and you know, the Times doesn't usually include the name of the victim. And so I think in this case, the editors felt like maybe it was probably better to remove it. And in removing her name, they removed the other reference to the fact that she didn't remember
it. Okay, so...
Mm-hmm. Right.
Victim. What victim?
Mm-hmm.
How can they... Isn't it part of their whole kind of like worldview, Tim, that you don't get to victimize... you don't get to ascribe victim status to somebody else, right?
Here's a question for you.
Doesn't the person whose penis had Kavanaugh's hand thrust into it get to decide for herself whether she was a victim or not?
Here's the question. If the legacy media is not out to get Donald Trump and every conservative and everybody he's appointed and everybody who's a friend or in his cabinet, if they're not really out to get him, how come every time the New York Times or the Washington Post or CNN makes a mistake, it's always in the direction of the left.
Right, right.
The mistake
it's like a cashier that always is a dollar wrong in favor of the store, you know?
Precisely.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, just ponder that question. If there wasn't a naked bias, then how come the New York Times or the CNN didn't accidentally run into a story where Trump looked good, but they found out later that it wasn't true? It's not happened one time that I can remember, Scott. Not once.
I have been a critic of the New York Times for, I don't know, over 25 years, I'm guessing, in terms of their bias.
I got years on you there.
Absolutely. Yeah. And Tim, you could say, and somebody could say to me, are you an insane person? You've been saying it for 20, why do you even, you know, giving them 10 seconds of your time? And there's just something about it that, because of the position it has had in our society, that I still would hope that this kind of, again, it's well beyond fake, Archie, you know, upset as well. It's well beyond fake news. It's, again, reporting, the real report is that Blasey Ford's claims have lost credibility in the past year, massively so, with Leland Kaiser's now coming forward, not under pressure of blackmail or of being ruined personally.
And there was no reason for this person to come forward.
Right. No, she's been contacted by the authors of this book.
Right. In other words, there's no compelling
personal interest. She didn't get paid $1 million
like, she didn't get
like
paid
Blasey
for
Ford, by
She
the
didn't
way.
Get off the hook for something. She didn't have something that they had on her to force her not to do it or whatever.
Yeah. Not to mention the fact of the Blasey Ford lawyers, which that's we won't even get into that subtopic. All right. Well, I think we can maybe put a pin in that and get those pants up around the story and
it might
not
be worth playing Jill Abramson, who's been the public face of the New York, or was, of course, for about a dozen years, the face of the New York Times and the media, former editor of the New York Times.
I mean, no one has challenged the basic accuracy of the story that they published. It's true that a material fact was left out, and the Times ran an editor's note.
By the way, it's her tone.
It's insufferable. That's why I needed to play it.
Explaining that, which is what you do when you leave something out. But it was no conspiracy to, you know, leave out that fact.
Of course not.
It was, you know, unfortunately cut from the piece.
Well, here's the thing. I actually agree with her in the sense that it was a conspiracy.
Yeah.
There need not be a discussion. That's the problem with the blindness that's occurring in the institution. But all right, listen, let's go to their blindness in other areas. I think we've talked about Justice Kavanaugh's penis enough for the rest of the decade.
for this century.
Yes. Okay. We've got a Biden report, and Tim, I've become for this week the uprising correspondent, the uprising's, what's her name? Elizabeth Warren for president correspondent Warren report.
I'm greatly looking forward
to it. Yes, well, let's go with the Biden report first, and then we can get into what the senator from Massachusetts has to say.
Okay, well, let me engage in an initial act of shameless self-promotion because—
Let me promote it for you, Tim. About to occur on LibertyNation.com, the outlet for your written work. People can read a big column, and I mean big in the sense of you're taking a stance, a position to be judged on regarding the Biden candidacy.
Not a position, a prediction. Let's be clear, prediction.
By the way, in the marketplace, that's a position, and that's how I'm referring to it.
Oh, okay. Market position.
Indeed. Okay. Why don't you tell the people what the market position is?
Market position.
Yes.
Well, the market position is what the betting odds are, essentially. And
On Joe Biden's candidacy.
It's interesting as a lead into this because let's go back to July 9th, just after the July 4th holiday.
Mm-hmm.
I went up, and I think I was the first columnist online that I know of to go online with a prediction that Donald Trump will win re-election and will win 350 votes in the Electoral College at least. So I consider that a pretty bold prediction, but I felt pretty strongly and still do that that is correct. And so I'm looking at the Biden situation, and I felt like now was a good time to express the instinct that I've had all along. And it's not just an instinct. It's actually a matter, really, of simple math, Scott. Biden is at 30%, right?
Mm-hmm.
He came into the race at 30%. Before he ever entered, he was at 30%. He announces candidacy's at 30%. 2 months later, he's at 30%. Now, 5 months later, almost, he's at 30%. So he's been steady at 30%. His lead has never dropped below 10%, right? But he's the only candidate who has a chance who is not a progressive. So simple math says 30% for Biden, 70% for everybody else. So we're in a field of 20 candidates that's going to narrow it to two or three eventually. When you add up the votes of all those candidates are going to drop out, how many of the supporters of those candidates are going to go to Joe Biden? Okay, every one of those people is a progressive. And when either... Klobuchar's at 1%. Mm-hmm. She's the high watermark. The rest of them are people like Delaney and Hickenlooper who don't even add up to 1%.
Okay, so, but I'm just strictly speaking.
Strictly speaking.
They're not all conservative but or progressive, but out of that 70%, would you say 60% of the – excuse me.
Well, now we get into tricky math because you say 70%, 60%. Right. But if you take that –
The remainder, the
universe of 70%.
Right.
You're talking about Beto O'Rourke.
Right.
You're talking about Cory Booker.
Yes.
You're talking about Kamala Harris because she's frankly in the also-ran category herself at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And then you take out either, this is the big one, Scott, you take out either Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders. And then you add up the supporters of Beto O'Rourke and Cory Booker and all the other lefties, Julian Castro,
Hang on, let me finish. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Because when they drop out, does Biden have a chance to pick up from his 30%? He hasn't gained from 30% from the time he entered the race. He's only in a position to lose his lead and to lose it big time, Scott.
All right, let's do some math here.
So here's my prediction, and then we can go through the possible flaws in it.
Right.
The prediction is that Joe Biden, this is the header for the story. Joe Biden is doomed.
Mm-hmm.
Joe Biden cannot win the nomination, and it's a matter of pure mathematics. Unless there's a miracle and the party suddenly realizes, wow, unless we start sounding more like Biden, we're going to lose in a landslide. But there's absolutely no indication that the Democratic Party is prepared to do that. All the energy is on the progressive side. All the energy is behind these neo-socialist proposals like the Green New Deal and Medicare for all, open borders, free health care for illegal immigrants. It's all in that direction. It's really not that hard to figure out that Biden doesn't stand to gain from that 30% in the primary. Now, in the general election, it might be different.
No, I understand we're talking about the primary. You know? All right, let's get into the numbers here. Okay, we've got to just bring it down to like base level. There's 70 people who are not choosing Joe Biden out of the 100, okay?
Okay.
They're choosing another Democrat candidate.
All right.
How many of those people want just to beat Donald Trump? They don't really care who you know, they could vote for Archie as long as he beats Donald Trump.
I would say a good half, probably, I'd say in the neighborhood of 45 to 55%.
Okay, so 45% of 7, let's call it even 40 on the low side. 40% of 70 is how many?
I know where you're going with this.
All right, well, I'm trying to, yeah, there you go.
And let me respond.
All right, well, let me, for people who haven't made the jump, what's 40% of 70, roughly speaking?
Well, I know where you're going with this. It's just going to confuse people. You want Tim to do math.
No, I don't.
40% of 70. All right, well,
roughly.
10% is 7, so 7 times 4 is 28, so that's 28.
So if we take our 28% of that, then, and add it to the 30 he initially had, right? No, now we're at
58%
of support for Joe Biden.
But this,
so I'm just thinking...
It's based
words,
on a false premise.
Go ahead, tell me what's
false
about
premise
it.
Is that everybody in the Democratic Party, including the progressives, really believe that Joe Biden is so, air quotes here, electable, that...
that they're going to make that choice. You mean that's not an obvious choice for them to make.
Well, they all want to beat Trump. And that's as low as second on the list
okay.
to anybody. But I think These people are so deranged. I mean, I honestly believe the progressive base is so addled with hatred and venom for Trump that they believe that Elizabeth Warren, in particular, maybe not Bernie Sanders, but a lot of them do, is the most electable Democrat.
Mm-hmm. She may be at this point. Do you have a made a prediction in your piece that you'll share with the uprising audience with Joe Biden doomed? Who is undoomed? Who will rise?
Well, not ideologically, but politically, I've been reasonably impressed with Pocahontas's campaign because Scott, you know, she's the only one. If you look at it, there's 20 candidates. This is an actual remarkable truth. There's 20 candidates in the race. There were originally 25 at the height of the stampede. Okay. Out of them, the only one out of those 25 that actually has gained ground the whole time is Elizabeth Warren. Everybody else has been stalled or moved backwards.
Okay. Well, when will we know if your prediction is, like, what's the time horizon on your prediction? Is it the first primary? Is that when we'll know if he's really doomed or not? Or is it about a money thing, too?
I think that's mathematical, too, because we don't know how long. For example, the big equation, again, goes back to Bernie and Pocahontas, and they are in the midst of a non-aggression pact.
Gotcha.
Clearly, they're not saying anything bad about each other. They stand for almost identical things, all the radical stuff, both of them. But one of them's not going to make it. And so when one doesn't make it, will it be because the other one has decided they have to go on the offensive?
Right.
Or is it because people have just decided, as I think they would, if they're going to have a progressive, if you're going to have someone who's going to advance a radical agenda, Elizabeth Warren is the way to make it go down.
She's
probably the most easy with the American people.
Plus you toss in, you don't want
to. I mean, Bernie
They've got an anti-Semitic problem, too, on their side of the aisle.
Well, that's so true. No, you're right.
She's a more attractive candidate.
But I mean, Bernie is just wakes up angry and goes to bed even angrier every day.
That's an attractive feature. That's a feature for me.
He just screams at the camera, and the idea of him wearing the course of a campaign, not to mention his insane ideas for just trashing the whole economy and starting over.
Well, we'll see after my Warren report if you agree. All right, let's talk about this.
The Warren report?
Let's talk about
this. Our own Warren report.
Hey, listen, I hope if she's the nominee, I've really positioned myself well in the marketplace of uprising correspondents, being able to deliver a report on her. All right, what about this Biden clip?
This is exemplary of the problem that Joe Biden has, trying to convince the radical wing of the Democratic Party that he's one of them. Because basically that's what he's tried to do, Scott. You know, he's renounced his positions, for example, on the Hyde Amendment, which he supported for years. He's apologized for the crime bill, which he authored in the 1990s, which was popular then, toxic now. And it's just a bridge too far for him, especially when all of his progressive opponents will start bombarding him with statements he's made from the past, from his 40-year career, like this one.
We have to join together to ensure that drug dealers are punished swiftly, surely, and severely. And in line with what the president is calling for, we have to hold every drug user accountable.
That's Reagan. He's talking about Reagan.
Yeah.
And loving what Reagan was doing and trying to support Reagan. I mean, this guy.
Nobody was tougher on crime than Uncle Joe.
You know, you got a 40-year record. Even if you've had a good 40-year record, it's so easy to pluck stuff to tear you down.
They always say it's so hard to run from the Senate for the executive because of that.
Well, it's true.
Yeah.
I mean, when you're not the guy in charge.
Yeah.
I mean, when you were before. I use the example of those three former Virginia governors, Scott, you know, George Allen and the two that are in there now, Mark Warner and Tim Kaine.
Yeah.
Okay. All three of them were governors of Virginia, all went on to the United States Senate. And by all accounts, because I know some people who know a guy who knows
Some people.
None of them enjoy it. And I think a big part of it, enjoyed it or enjoy it, and a big part of it is being part of a 100 senator gaggle with the the filibuster rule. They don't even have any power.
You don't get the motorcade. First of all, right there, you're done.
No, it's true.
You know,
okay.
I mean,
Scott,
maybe if you're.
Thank you for boiling it down to its basics. I love when you do that.
Listen, when you see that motorcade come through, can you imagine how awesome that would really be to just be able to go through traffic? Forget about it. That alone is worth any amount of.
Anyway, that kind of statement, you know, they're going to use that against him, that the guy is really a closet right-wing reactionary or something like that. I mean, who knows what they'll go ahead. But the point is, you've got all the guns fired at him from everyone except maybe the Democratic National Committee. Now, let me just put it this way, because people are going to say, Joe Biden is doomed, the guy's leading. Come on, aren't you exaggerating perhaps more than a little bit? Well, let me put it this way. We've already done the 70% thing. But how about the idea, and there's some credence to it, I suppose, in theory, that if the Democratic Party writ large determines that, look, we're not going to beat Trump, that it would be better to throw to the wolves Joe Biden, because he'll be done anyway.
Right, then use up a Pete Buttigieg candidacy who may actually be the next president of the United States.
Instead of sullying up and tarnishing somebody who could be a future of the party, because I think they believe, and the reason this is possible is because I think they believe right now that their real target is 2024. I don't think they believe that they will beat Trump. I think in their heart of hearts, they believe they can. But not that they will, but they want to position themselves for 2024, believing that the demographics are only moving in their favor in terms of minorities, in terms of Hispanics, in terms of, I suppose, in terms of millennials, although that always changes when they're no longer millennials. But I think that's what they're positioning themselves for.
Well, I hope that Warren isn't in that position based on what I heard her say at her big rally. This was Elizabeth Warren's, I think, second rally.
It was very big.
She's trying to do a Trump-style big rally. Tim, I find myself, I have to be some freaking men's rights activist because I have to, there's so much anti-male energy out there. I have the Maisie Hirono's clip and as part of the uprising theme song where he tells men to just shut up.
And do the right thing for a change.
Elizabeth Warren, as I see her rally here, Tim, thinks she's going to elevate herself to president on the backs of men. Here's how she started her rally when she came out. We're going to do a little Name That Tune. We'll see how long it takes you to guess what song it is.
Okay.
Tumble out of bed and I stumble to the kitchen for myself a cup of ambition.
From Working Girl. What was it? I've heard it a million times.
Shower and the blood starts pumping out on the street.
Dolly.
The traffic starts jumping with folks like
it's
me.
Dolly. It's Dolly. It's 9 to 5. There you go.
Working 9 to 5.
By the way, who can write a catchy tune, right? Dolly Parton. Wow. Just all talent on that side of the equation. But this was the rallying call or whatever of the woman who goes for the working woman. Right. And this is Elizabeth Warren. And if that musical introduction wasn't clear about what this rally was about, well, she's not going to leave it up to us to guess or take the metaphor.
I am especially glad to be here in Washington Square Park. I wanted to give this speech right here, and not because of the arch behind me or the president that this square is named for. Nope. We are not here today because of famous arches or famous men. In fact, we're not here because of men at all.
Wow.
We're not here because of men at all.
Wow.
And then the crowd goes wild.
Again, you make that kind of statement, you know, in I guess I wouldn't say heat of the moment. That's obviously a prepared remark. Does she not think that that will be used against her and just turn men completely off, and she'll be left with only her portion of the women's vote in a general election? I mean, I don't understand why it's necessary for her to. She doesn't have to do that. That's the point. She's on the rise. You know, it's time for her to start thinking longer term, like, if I overtake Biden, I need to sound less threatening. But apparently that just goes right over her head.
Never let it be said that she will miss the opportunity to divide us by our race, by our sex, by our any immutable characteristic that she can then use to elevate herself
and discriminate,
and her
candidacy. And discriminating against non-Native Americans as well.
It's as disgusting to denigrate men as it is to denigrate women. And that's what my feminist mother taught me, which was that women and men should expect the same from their government and from society, with how each of them are respected. And this kind of denigration, anti-male denigration, it should be just as unacceptable for her to say that as a male to say the analogous with respect to a female.
I hadn't heard that clip yet. But you know what? That is son of deplorables. That's how big a mistake it is to do that, to take 49% of the electorate and just call them as irresponsible and not responsible for anything that this country is.
It gets even worse, Tim.
Is that possible?
The purpose of her bringing this up was to tell us the story of this horrible fire, the shirtwaist factory fire. Have you heard of this before?
Vaguely.
Yeah, I vaguely heard of it too. I refreshed my recollection after Warren, and we're gonna hear Elizabeth Warren tell us about the story, and then maybe I'll poke in with some details.
Worked long hours in a brown 10-story building just a block that way. Women who worked at the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory. So here's what I want you to hear. It was March 25th, 1911. It was a Saturday. And at about 4:45 in the afternoon, people walking through this very park looked up and saw black smoke billowing into the sky. A fire had started in that building. And inside that building, on the top three floors, deadly flames leapt from a bin to the oily floors and from the floors to the walls, sweeping across workrooms and trapping the workers, fighting for their lives. Women, girls really, some as young as 14, raced to escape, but the exit doors were locked. Others ran to the windows, waving their arms and screaming for help. No help was coming. The fire department's ladders could only reach to the sixth floor. The flames leapt higher, and women started crawling out onto the ledges. And as people on the ground stood in shocked silence, a woman jumped. And then another, and then another. They hit the ground with a sickening thud. They died on impact, so many so fast that the women's bodies piled up on the sidewalk. Their blood ran into the gutters. Dozens more were trapped inside. Trapped because the door to the staircase was locked. Locked by bosses afraid that the workers might steal scraps of cloth. Firefighters would later find a pile of burned bodies next to that locked door.
Okay, now.
What?
Why go through all that, okay? Here's what the important takeaway is, I think, Tim. She couches this disaster, this horrible fire, in two buckets. Bucket number one is these women, these poor, victimized women who were murdered by this system. And number two is the evil corporations, okay? Well, the first thing we have to learn is that it's a lie that the first person to jump from the factory was a woman. It was a man who jumped to his death. Also, there were dozens, a couple dozen men who died. It was mostly women because mostly women were these garment factory workers.
Right.
But the idea that it was there were no male victims of this, there were dozens of male victims. Where are they accounted for? Right? In this, isn't in Elizabeth Warren's world where every single possible exception to anything has to be noted and embraced, right? We have to say, we can't just say ranchers, we have to say farmers, we have to say trans women of color from Indonesia who were born in Cuba but now identify as something else. Like, in other words, every little exception, right, has to be. But the dozens of men, Tim, and their deaths are not recognized. Now let's talk about the corporate aspect of it, right? About the locked door and what that sounds like, okay? Well, the owners of the factory, Tim.
When did this happen, by the way? Roughly.
I've got the, this is the Wikipedia, so 1911.
Okay. So 108 years ago.
The owners of the factory, Tim, when they heard about this from their beachfront chairs in Palm Beach, their monocle popped from. No, I'm sorry. It wasn't. Right. They were lighting a cigar with a $100 bill from the Waldorf Astoria at the time.
Right.
No,
that's right.
I'm wrong. On this Saturday, where were the owners? These fat cat owners of this factory, Tim?
Robber barons. Please call them robber
they
barons.
They were in the factory with who? Their children.
They were in the factory with their children oppressing the workers, actively oppressing the workers,
So, let's think about
Scott.
That for a second. In Elizabeth Warren's narrative that she has to sell, right, that she has to push.
From 108 years ago.
That it's a fat cat sitting on a beach somewhere where these poor women are basically being burned to death so he can get an extra $100 bill to light his Monte Cristo from. And in reality, okay, it's a bunch of poor Jews that hire another bunch of poor Jews trying to make it so they get a crust of freaking bread, okay, in this life, right, to try
Pretty
to
simple.
Make it in
yep.
America.
That was
and where
the-
are they on the factory? Where are they on a Saturday afternoon, Tim, with their kids in the same factory with the same locked door? I made this point when we talked about the Koch brothers. They don't have special air that they get to breathe. So the idea that David Koch wants to poison the air, he lives in the air too. These shirtwaist factory people, yes, locking that door was horribly unsafe and they shouldn't have done it. But it wasn't like this guy like, ha, 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 who cares if we, lose a lot of workers. No, they themselves were subjecting themselves to that danger.
She'll just say she was using creative license to enhance the story a little for the purposes of sharing it with the massive crowd at Washington Square in New York.
And then she goes on, and I'll save you from another minute of Elizabeth Warren's voice.
Praise God, from whom all blessings flow, not the least of which is this one being spared more Pocahontas.
But she goes on to say basically they use their connections to have no consequences occur to them. Tim, they were tried for murder by the city. The city tried them for murder.
But other than that, Scott.
I ask you.
No consequences.
This idea, I don't know. It's so anti, the idea that a person, and, I think it's the same situation where I once heard David Koppel is a famous gun policy expert. And he was talking once about some white supremacist sort of anti-government types, Idaho, survivalist types that he knew. And somebody was asking him about, their opinions of New York bankers, right? And Koppel was saying, they just don't know New York bankers. If they did, they wouldn't have a problem. I happen to know plenty right. of them, and they're just not, Yeah. And if some really high net worth people, the idea that they haven't worked for what they've achieved or are somehow this, it's the same villainous kind of, it's the same, by the way, it could be the welfare queen in reverse, right? They're both these caricatures
by the way,
of people. That bear little resemblance to actual human beings.
Let me tell you what it is. To say that about people who have innovated and worked their butts off their entire life to build something special, you know what it is? That's a blood libel against this class of people. People who have succeeded using the American way. And I got to get this
in. And not their imagined race, by the way, to advance in the marketplace of jobs like Pocahontas did.
Right. Let's not forget that. Scott, I cannot wait for the next election because I cannot wait for the American people to weigh in on all of this garbage, all of this stuff that's happening, all of this identity politics, all of this dividing people up by their racial and gender identity, all of this bowing to these massive government takeovers of entire industries, the end of fossil fuels, the end of private health care, the end of borders, these kind of things. I am anxious to see the American people cast their votes next November, because if it's like I predicted and like I still think, it's going to be the most thorough renunciation of a radical ideology ever in American history. And that's for a simple reason, Scott. These people are further to the left by far than any other field of candidates in American history by far.
Well, I hope that Americans reject the creeping socialism that seems to be out there. I tell you, I appreciate your remarking upon the climate change, climate justice issue, and we'll take that opportunity to tease now a special edition Uprising podcast to be released soon, outside of our regular weekly order, focusing solely on climate change.
Climate justice.
Excuse me. Climate. Is that – there was probably a new one. We're probably evidencing
– It is.
No, there's probably a new one after that we haven't even – in other words, we're already –
You can't keep up because last week it was climate catastrophe. Now it's climate justice.
We're talking about Thursday at 5:18, and I think – and I will check this.
Eastern time.
Eastern time. And just to confirm
– I don't even know. Is it standard or daylight now? I never get that straight.
And it's sad to say that – For the record, the Mets sit atop the Phils at the NL East. We're sad to report, but we will report it.
For you know what? You just established your base integrity.
Thank you, sir.
That the Mets, especially with the major embarrassing, humiliating mistake you made last week to say that the Phillies were ahead of the Mets when in fact they were tied.
It was a mistake, and
viewers
of the podcast, also available now on video, and I've gotten some nice comments about my sneaker game, Tim, and I'm going to continue to try to impress in that regard.
Are you deliberately not turning the Adidas symbol to the camera so as not to seem like you're promoting
last week I had a Chick-fil-A cup and I was wearing Nikes, and I thought there are political implications potentially for both of those brands. And
as George H.W. Bush might have said, Chick-fil-A out, Uprising in.
Yeah.
I'm going to stick with that.
Let's talk about journalistic integrity on this last clip, Tim. Okay. This is from Chuck Todd. You know, I don't have a great sense of that's the situation in Saudi Arabia. Who's at fault, and what should be done about it? But
it's
certainly
Iran.
Well,
we don't know that for sure, but it's
that's
almost
what I've heard
certainly.
Talking heads say.
Or Iranian interests.
Yeah. Well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Perhaps that's right, but this I think is. Well, I'll just let Chuck Todd say.
Okay.
It.
The president of the United States has said he doesn't believe the New York Times is a tribunal, which means I will lie to the press. Corey Lewandowski said he lies to that he does not believe that it is not a sin to lie to the press. What should we do? I don't. What am I supposed to believe on Iran? What am we supposed to believe? And how do we deal with this as a press corps? We have a hostile administration that is trying to exploit cynicism about the press.
Right.
But I'm sitting here going, boy, I want triple verification on what you guys announced.
Okay. Why isn't it a hostile relationship between the press and every administration, Tim? That's the question I want to ask. Why is it hunky-dory? Like, there's been no...
Even in the wake of
the Donald Trump presidency, there's been no self-reflection. Yes, we want you to triple-check. George W. Bush lied us into war. That's a direct quote from Donald Trump at the South Carolina primary, Tim. Why aren't we triple-checking all big stories like, gee, should we go to war against a country?
What, then, is the role of a free press? Is it to collaborate with the government, or is it to hold the government to account, writ large, all government at all times? not to attack them on a vendetta and to protect them when they believe the same things that you do. It's about that simple.
Thank you so much for joining us, Tim Donner, Archie the Podcasting Dog. The Uprising is a podcast of LibertyNation.com. Tim, why don't you plug the radio show, which we don't plug very often on The Uprising. Tell people where they can get it and when
it's
released.
Well, look, you know, people who want to double dip into climate justice will like the fact that we're running the second part of our interview with Patrick Michaels, Pat Michaels, former environmental czar at Cato Institute, and now he's at Competitive Enterprise Institute. He is the go-to guy for actual facts about climate change and putting in perspective the hysteria. First part last week, second part this week, both available online. That's one of the highlights of the show because, you know, we just need to hammer away at this stuff over and over.
And we're going to talk more about that on the Uprising Special
Edition.
And another special treat for everybody after the closing theme music. Stay tuned and thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye.
LibertyNation.com hosts so many things, one of which is another podcast called The Rabbit Hole, Politics and Prose, hosted by Mark Angelides, the managing editor. It's a really good podcast. It's short. It's a different format than The Uprising, but if you like The Uprising, I think you'll like The Rabbit Hole. So instead of sending you elsewhere to go fetch it, we've fetched it and appended it here for your listening pleasure. Give it a try. Thanks. Bye.
What if stories and legends can offer us the key to unraveling the hottest political issues of the day? What would it mean if all the answers to today's burning questions were presented in easy-to-digest narratives and myths? Join us as we examine some of the most fascinating tales, some mythological, some historical, and apply their lessons to understanding the chaos of modern politics. I'm your host, Mark Angelides. Welcome to The Rabbit Hole, Politics and Prose, a LibertyNation.com production. It is often in the tales and legends of the past that we see reflections of present circumstance. When our media and televisions are filled with an air of desperation, with politicians seeking one last chance at seizing power, it's worth looking to the old myths. It can't have escaped your attention that the recent swathe of Democrat candidates, the outliers as opposed to the old guard, are having difficulty breaking into the top spot. They don't have the donors, they don't have the coverage, and they don't have the support. What they do have is an almost shameless will to succeed. It appears that they will say anything and go to any extremes to get those few extra inches of column space, in the hopes that it will tip the scales of fortune. I'm reminded of the ancient Greek legend of Tantalus. You may be familiar with the name from Homer's Odyssey, but the real in-depth aspects of the story just keep on bringing similarities to mind. The crimes of Tantalus were indeed terrible, and so too was his punishment. But perhaps it was a deserved one. When people go to extreme lengths in their petty pursuits of power and favor, it's hard to feel sympathy. When we see presidential candidates willing to say anything, go to any extremes to ensure their position, it becomes a sad window into the souls of shallow people who would gladly commit any offense. Tantalus was a supposedly mythical king of Sipylus, the demigod offspring of Zeus. Although there's a lot of etymological evidence there that he may have existed, his kingdom being an Anatolian city. We hear a lot about Tantalus and his crimes, but different sources suggest he was guilty of many different things. At the root of all of them, however, was the greater glory of Tantalus himself. Being a king, he was already wealthy, and as with many of an ancient myth or legend, the story we hear is often a parable to describe a sin, a poetic rendering to illustrate the inbuilt and often rotten traits of man. The first iteration of a crime by our wicked king is that, as a member of the first generation of mortals born to gods, he was invited to share a table on Olympus. Not content with just being one of the honored few to partake, Tantalus decided that he would steal ambrosia and nectar from the gods and bestow the godly knowledge on the rest of humanity. Sure, this sounds good to us mere mortals. Who are these gods to keep the knowledge to themselves, right? But remember, this tale represents something else. It's not just the words, it's the meaning behind them. So what is the truth wrapped in the fairy tale here? One unravelling of the story suggests that Tantalus was not seeking to share the godly wisdom to benefit the people, but rather as a way of creating glory and gratitude among the people for himself. He was giving the desperate masses, who, let's remember, they were desperate because he was their king. He was seeking to give them something that they would thank him for, but it was never his to give. There's a lot of sins to unpack here. He makes the people miserable with his wicked ruling, and then seeks to make them happy, only in as much as he can gain the glory and respect by giving something that isn't his to give. Is there more than just a hint of tax the rich and love me for it here? We can see this as politicians being oh so generous with wealth that isn't their own in the hopes of winning love, respect, or even just votes. And what of his other crimes? Perhaps the most famous of which also takes place at a dinner party with the gods. Here, Tantalus decides to cut up his own son, Pelops, and feed him to the visiting gods disguised as regular meat. The gods, being gods, realize what's happening and don't eat. But Demeter, the Earth Mother goddess, and the goddess of fertility for the Earth, distraught over not finding her daughter, who just so happens to have been whipped away by a love-struck Hades, she eats some of the meat, the shoulder specifically, without knowing that this is human flesh. Now the gods, they get pretty mad. But why would Tantalus do such a thing? The legends suggest that this was to test the gods' knowledge and their powers of observation. Yet this doesn't make a huge amount of sense. If we look at the character and the vices of Tantalus, however, and again, understand that this is a parable on the condition of man, it becomes a little bit clearer. Tantalus wanted to elevate himself. He wanted to be the man who could fool the very gods, thereby setting himself above them. But it was not enough just to be intellectually superior and fool them with a simple trick. He wanted to be morally superior to those who would eat the flesh of his son. This may have been the world of legend's first attempt at virtue signalling. Bringing it back to the present briefly, we see and hear politicians explaining how they are right, morally right, and superior to the opposition, because they have not partaken in XYZ. Consider racism in the US. You have one party that constantly decries the racism of another, practically sweating their virtue from every pore in their skin, raising themselves to the high moral plateau. And all the while, this same party is the very one that spent the majority of its existence in bed with the KKK. They create situations politically, and then use them as traps from which they will appear more virtuous than their opponent. To me, this is what the second crime of Tantalus represents. Of course, there are many more crimes, vices, and general ill manners attributed to Tantalus, but you get the idea. Perhaps just as clear an illustration is the punishment meted out by Zeus himself. His punishment is right up there with the best of them. It's almost as iconic as poor Sisyphus, condemned to roll a rock up a mountain for eternity. You see, Tantalus was sentenced to spend eternity neck deep in a lake. The water that he so desperately craved would shrink away whenever he tried to drink, leaving behind nothing but a dry soil floor. And above his head, there was the branch of a luscious fruit tree filled with perfect sustenance. But whenever he reached it, it would pull away just out of his grasp. He is to spend eternity in Tartarus, forever being teased with thirst and hunger. In fact, it is from the name Tantalus that we get the verb tantalize. This starkly wicked punishment is a wonderful and terrible reminder for all mortals who are tempted into immoral and impious behavior. It shows us that those who spend their time trying to elevate themselves, trying to better their position through dishonesty, all for the sake of avarice, they are ultimately doomed to failure. Now, that failure may not be in a spectacular fashion. It may be a far more personal hell that they inhabit, always striving, always reaching for, or trying to grab, and the fruits and the sustenance they crave being forever just outside their reach. Thank you for listening to The Rabbit Hole, Politics and Prose, a LibertyNation.com production. Join us next episode, where we'll be talking more history, politics, legends, and stories. Until next time, thanks for listening.